Please be seated. We wanted to inquire as to the first two cases, which is the U.S. Home and the Greystone cases, if you wanted the 60 minutes or are you wanted the 30-30? Did anybody discuss that with all of you?
Chief Justice, we did discuss it, and I think the desire of Mr. Shinnick was to take them separately because it makes it easier to address some issues that way.
Okay, that's fine.
With one little footnote, the second case, the McCoy case, has the identical CCNRs that were part of the Medina case that was argued on June 5th for this court. So, to that extent, it certainly be shorter.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I agree. In fact, the PSA is the same as the Medina case.
So we'll start with case number 68810, U.S. Home Corporation versus the Michael Ballesteros Trust. Mr. King for the appellant, Mr. Shinnick for respondents. Mr. King.
We seem to be getting feedback, Chief. I don't know.
I didn't notice.
If we are, we can.
Ms. Clerk, you going to do something about the feedback, or are we just going to sit here and look at each other?
Should we hold off a minute?
Yeah. Test 1, 2, 3. Test 1, 2, 3.
That's okay.
All right. I don't like to sit back, so I like to move forward. I like to lurk. Mr. King, now you may proceed.
If I could reserve 3 minutes for...
You got it.
May it please the court. My name is Greg King. I'm counsel for U.S. Home, the developer whose motion to compel arbitration was denied. As we just discussed, we were here about 30 days ago discussing similar issues relating to motions to compel arbitration that were denied by the construction defect judge, a different judge than it was 30 days ago. The arbitration agreements are a little different this time, but the result and the rationale of the lower court in denying arbitration and the issues are very similar. So what I thought I would do is highlight some of the issues instead of rehashing everything again and then address any issues or concerns that you all may have.
Well, my concern is what's unconscionable, what isn't unconscionable, is unconscionable even a player anymore in these cases? Should we not forget about unconscionability? In other words, is there such a thing as unconscionability in these arbitration agreements?
Great question, and I think it seems that question is stemming from the recent nursing kindred case, if I'm saying that right, the recent Supreme Court case that came out. That course case, I just happened to read last night, again, it emphasized that states still have the ability to refuse to enforce arbitration based upon contract offenses, such as fraud, duress, such as unconscionability. In that case, they didn't get to the unconscionability because that court confirmed what Concepcion confirmed. Namely, you cannot have a state implementing rules that on their face discriminate against arbitration. And that's what took place in that Kentucky Supreme Court case. The court there created a rule that put the arbitration agreements to a higher standard than other provisions within that power of attorney. And the court also went on to say you can't have a prima facie discrimination and you can't have a rule that covertly discriminates against arbitration. But I think the unconscionability analysis is still an applicable analysis. If the party contesting arbitration wants to show that arbitration is not enforceable, they're going to have to show some grounds, such as unconscionability.
Do we need to worry about substantive unconscionability and procedural unconscionability? Can we forget about those words and just worry about unconscionability?
I'm okay with calling them unconscionability. There's certainly aspects. There's a procedural aspect in that if a party is surprised or if there's an arbitration agreement that's hidden, that's confusing, that's in fine print, it's still unconscionable. It's kind of a more a procedural aspect, and then you have the substantive where if it's so unfair and one-sided that it shocks the conscience, that can also be unconscionable.
Justice Pickering, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to get your view of what is left of unconscionability, because the court is tasked with, the court evaluates whether there's an agreement to arbitrate, then the arbitrator evaluates the general contract defenses. So the court will always be assessing unconscionability in the context of the enforcement of the arbitration clause, correct?
Could you ask that one more time?
Yeah. Under prima facie, the court evaluates whether to enforce an agreement to arbitrate. It doesn't evaluate whether the contract as a whole is enforceable. It evaluates the agreement to arbitrate. Are you with me?
Yes, yes.
So if the court is evaluating unconscionability in the context of an agreement to arbitrate, it has to do with the exact arbitration clause. So it's a defense that is specific to the arbitration clause. Do you agree?
It is a defense that is specific to the arbitration clause, yes.
So my question is what's left of unconscionability, would it be unconscionable for an arbitration clause to say, for example, the plaintiff must arbitrate, but the defendant doesn't have to? Would that be so one-sided that you have unconscionability?
That the plaintiff has to arbitrate, but the defendant does not have to. I think that there is still an unconscionability analysis. So if the agreement is so one-sided, then I believe that's still a factor.
Okay, so the unconscionability defense survives, but it can't be that it's unfair to require someone to arbitrate. It's that it has to be one-sided.
I'm not sure I'm following the reason.
Unconscionability has to do with something that is unintelligible to a normal reader, i.e. procedural unconscionability.
Or surprise, and they didn't know, such as in the Green case, they didn't know the arbitration agreement was there because it was after the signature line in fine print. So there's a surprise element as well.
Okay. That would be the procedural piece of it, but the substantive piece of it is what I'm trying to focus on.
Okay.
To get to substantive unconscionability in the arbitration setting, I'm trying to have you tell me what would be an example of a substantively unconscionable, because it's so one-sided, arbitration agreement.
That is a great question. Because if it's not procedurally unconscionable, if it's clear and the parties clearly enter into it, can it be so substantively unconscionable that we're going to say...
So stay with me. Let's say we have some procedural unconscionability. It's the Green case you just said.
Yes.
It's after the signature lines, it's at the end, it's in upside down fine print. But you also need some substantive unconscionability, and I'm trying to have you tell me what would be substantively unconscionable in the arbitration setting.
Certainly something that is illegal, something that is against public policy. If you had an arbitration agreement that precluded certain parties from arbitrating, as I'm sitting here and thinking, I'm thinking that is probably substantively unconscionable.
Because it would be one-sided, right?
And it goes against the public policy of endorsing arbitration as well.
But that's a slippery slope for you, because Chapter 40 provides a lot of remedies, and the plaintiffs are saying those are inconsistent and therefore arbitration is inherently and counter to public policy because they're losing these statutorily secured benefits or claims.
Right, and there's a divergence there. In these cases, in all these appeals which are before the court, we have purposely avoided suggesting that we are trying to take away those Chapter 40 rights. If the question is, can we do that? I'm not sure. But that's not what we're doing here, because we have fully complied with Chapter 40.
Well, doesn't that also presume the arbitrator's not going to comply with Chapter 40 as he's arbitrating, she is arbitrating the dispute?
Oh, yeah, yes. In fact, we need to start with the basic premise that the arbitrator is going to follow the law. That is what the U.S. Supreme Court has said, and that's what this court has said in the D.R. Horton Green case. In fact, in that case, this court said, which I think is just perfect, by agreeing to arbitrate, a party does not forego the substantive rights afforded by the statute. It only submits to their resolution in an arbitral forum. So if you start with the premise that the arbitrator has to enforce the law and has to afford parties their rights and claims, then there's as you look at these provisions in these arbitration agreements, in my view, there's no question that those rights are still intact. It's very helpful to keep in mind that the right to attorney's fees under Chapter 40, under NRS 4655, that is an element of damages. It's not a tack on at the end for a prevailing party or some award of costs. It's an element of damages. And certainly the arbitrator, in deciding the damages that the homeowner or the claimant is entitled to, he or she cannot take away a damage element, such as an award of attorney's fees or costs. That's part of the damages. And so, and we have always been consistently arguing that there's no intent to take away those fees or costs from the claimants.
Is the record down below clear in terms of at the time of signing, whether or not all documents were tendered to the parties, i.e. the CC&Rs besides the contract proviso, or was it just referenced?
Question, is the record clear?
Was the record clear down below? Whether or not the parties actually got a copy of the CC&R, or was it just mentioned in the buy and sell contract?
I would say that those type of evidentiary burdens are on the claimants, and they have not presented any evidence to suggest that they, well, let me step back. There's 12 homeowners.
You've taken the affirmative position that the CC&Rs bind them. So my question is, was that part of the contract? Was that an addendum? Was it tendered?
But the CC&Rs are in and of themselves a contract. That's the agreement. Some of the parties, the original purchase and sell agreements, they're subsequent purchasers, so there's not a PSA.
Were they put on notice that the CC&Rs were incorporated into the contract, that they were bound by that?
Well, they're not incorporated into the purchase and sell agreements. They are their own independent contract and document.
So when does a potential buyer become aware that CC&Rs have application to them?
That's an issue that's always a conundrum with regard to CC&Rs.
Well, you're wanting to hold them responsible and, I'll say, limit their right to go to trial based upon provisions pertaining to CC&R. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So when do they become aware that they're bound by those?
Well, pursuant to NRS 116, they're obligated. They must be provided a copy of the CC&Rs. NRS 116 says that whether you've read them or not, you're bound by the CC&R.
You said they're bound, they must receive a copy?
Right, and they're bound.
So when?
Well, certainly, I think the understanding is at the time of the purchase, because they have that 5-day cool-off to review those documents and to determine
and
whether or not.
And was the record developed as to whether or not that occurred?
The record is not developed that 10 of the 12 homeowners are contesting that issue. I think the record is clear. At no point have the claimants suggested that they're not bound by the CC&R.
Well, it's not a question of being bound. Even being bound, you have to go through certain procedure to be bound by. Other question, though, is whether or not this is inter or intrastate, and whether they were buying a finished product or buying something that was going to be built so that
Sure. The
construction is that issue posed to.
Sure, and I feel like we've had this discussion before. Let me respond to that question in a number of ways. First of all, you know, talking about the arbitration agreements at this hearing as well as the next hearing, three of those four agreements agree. They stipulate that the FAA applies. So that's like a choice of law provision, and those are enforceable. And this court has determined this is enforceable. Setting that aside, the test is whether you look at whether the transaction being evidenced by the contract, that transaction being the construction of new homes, and the construction of a common common interest development, and the marketing and selling of those homes, whether or not that involves interstate commerce. We don't need to conduct discovery to determine whether or not the sinks or the HVAC systems or any of that.
Let's stop right there, because the law, you're making it sound like the law is just one-sided totally, and it's not, because there is case law. It makes that distinction depending on how it's done. Yes, I agree that. But the other argument is the properties here in Nevada, if you're buying something that's finished, it's intra, it's not necessarily inter, but it can be.
I'm not aware of, and I say this carefully, I'm not aware of a single case throughout this country in which a court has held that the construction of a new home does not involve interstate commerce. There's been cases.
The way that you're phrasing it, the construction of. But I'm saying, what are you in fact buying as a buyer? Am I buying a home, quote, completed, or am I buying something to be built?
You're buying a home that you are participating in the construction of, in choosing fixtures and tile and flooring and coverings for that home. You're buying a newly constructed home that's being built for you. So yes, and let's assume that all of the elements of the construction of that home were in Nevada, as counterintuitive as that is. The economic effect of home building in the national economy is so strong that we don't need to determine whether or not these elements are from Nevada. That the construction of home building and of common interest communities across this country, and we have our Fortune 500 home builders, many of them, that shows you how significant home building is on the economy, and therefore it affects interstate commerce.
Well, possibly if it was that significant, then I would think that the federal side, just like we have the FAA, might have adopted their own set of construction defect laws for the whole nation opposed to the state-by-state application.
Well,
because Nevada has adopted and said
sure.
They think it's important to look at it and provide certain rights to the buyer.
I'm not sure that we would need Congress to enact a comprehensive construction defect law. That would be some micromanaging that would not be wise in my view.
Some people would think that the FAA applied to construction defect is not wise either.
But the FAA is applying the local state laws in the arbitral form. We're not changing the substantive laws. The state laws apply in that form. And so if one state has certain laws that apply to construction defect issues, those law applies. If Nevada has its unique laws, those law applies.
So you're basically conceding that if the arbitrator doesn't follow Chapter 40, then it's up for review and possible?
Absolutely. The parties have completed Chapter 40. Chapter 40 is done. If the arbitrator does not award damages pursuant to that damage provision, then that would be a violation of law. Absolutely.
Okay. May I have one more question?
Sure.
Sorry. There's a dispute in this first case about the delegation clause in the arbitration agreement, and you raise it in your brief, and Mr. Shinnick answers that you did not raise that in district court. Is he correct on that?
He is correct.
Okay,
and so we raised it in our opening brief. We did not respond in the reply brief because it wasn't raised below. And if I could comment on that issue, there, we've been reading this issue for a couple years now, and it's my client's belief that we need direction from this court. There's a lot of confusion. We've had to appeal denials and motions to compel arbitration from four different district court judges in the construction defect panel, all different arbitration agreements. We have parties like the plaintiffs who are arguing in all their briefs that construction defect claims are not appropriate for arbitration. We have the Nevada Justice Association.
We understand that, but I was just focusing on the delegation clause. I don't mean to be discourteous, but we have a...
Okay, sure. I would encourage court to make a ruling on that. But we did not argue that down below.
Right, I get your point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Shinnick.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Schenck, I know you have a lot of issues to raise here. I kind of had a follow-up to what Justices Douglas and Pickering said about the substantive procedural unconscionability, and I was curious if the record reflects in this case and the next one, and we had the Medina case previously, when the CC&Rs were distributed to the purchasers. Were they distributed when you sign the offer and acceptances, or were they distributed with a stack of documents at the close of escrow by the title company, or if that's in the record, if that even came up in your proceedings below?
I'm not sure it's more training for the plans. I'm not sure it's actually in the record. It appears that it was distributed at the closing point along with a stack of other documents.
Okay. But that's not in the record. That's just your recollection.
Okay. Thank you.
To follow up on that question, though, is counsel correct? You didn't raise that below or here.
We did provide declarations from a few of the homeowners about the stack of documents that they were provided with essentially no explanation. And candidly, some of those documents, homeowners' declarations, were that they did not read the CC&Rs. That's the state of the record below.
But there are two declarations only, and one says that there were too many papers. He doesn't disavow having received them, correct?
I think that's correct.
Yeah.
But legally, you don't raise that as a basis for avoiding arbitration.
Only to the extent that for example, the CC&R provision on page 76 of the 86-page document, plus all the other exhibits, is an indicator of procedural unconscionability. That it's buried in the middle of a lengthy document, nothing to bribe attention. In fact, the title of that, 17.16 arbitration, does not even refer to construction defect claims. It is an overall arbitration provision dealing with HOA homeowner disputes, a developer subcontractor disputes, all those sorts of things. And that argument is made in the pleadings that that's part of the procedural unconscionability.
But in this particular case, you've got some number of plaintiffs who are original purchasers, where the question concerning their receipt of the CC&Rs might be germane. But most of these folks appear to be subsequent purchasers.
That's correct.
Where the seller's responsibility for providing the CC&Rs wouldn't fall on the contractor, he's gone, or that entity's gone. So why wouldn't we look at this issue the same way we look at other issues in which we're looking at constructive notice resulting from the recorded CC&Rs for subsequent purchases? Or is this whole analysis different between an original purchaser and a subsequent purchaser?
It differs slightly in that the subsequent purchaser is not part of the sale transaction. But I think the term the court used is similar to the term that was used in the Pinnacle case in California. They basically said the CC&Rs are there, you're going to be bound by them. But even the California case and the Pinnacle case has never gone as far as to say, any term at all, no matter how unconscionable, if it's in the CC&Rs, we're going to enforce it. They did not go that far.
No. We're jumping too quickly. I just want to focus only on the question about whether CC&Rs apply not only to original purchasers and to subsequent purchasers for the same reason. That is, they're recorded against the property. Whether they were handed to the property owner or not in the original sale, or whether they were part of the recorded documents when the subsequent purchaser bought, it would seem like if we were to disregard that approach, we would be applying a different evaluation to recorded documents than we apply throughout the rest of the law.
No, I understand the wisdom in stating that the CC&Rs are there, everybody's bound by it, and that's a certain.
So if we conclude, even under 116 and under Recording Act constructive notice provisions, that the CC&Rs are applicable and they are binding, then the subsequent question then is whether or not the CC&Rs specifically declare the FAA as part of the arbitration or don't. I'm just trying to build a structure for this analysis. Well, because before you ever get to unconscionability, it would seem like you'd have to decide, and it seems as though you would concede, that the CC&Rs do apply to original purchasers and subsequent purchasers, whether the document was handed to them or whether it was part of the recorded documents. Do you agree with that?
I think the CC&Rs do apply.
All right.
And later purchases. But that does not mean that the sky's the limit.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that. I'm just trying to determine if the document applies to these people. If it does, then it seems like this court would focus its attention on whether or not any provision contained within the applicable document is unconscionable or not.
Yes.
Fair enough?
Yes, and that is what the court...
So why is the provision in this case, before we argue the next case, why is the provision in the CC&Rs in this case not applicable?
Because it attempts to abrogate Chapter 4. And the line of unbroken line of cases from Green to Birch to Gonski throughout has basically said, Chapter 40 is a matter of public policy to try to ensure minimum standards of construction in that. And that cannot be in an agreement or a sales agreement or attempts to abrogate those rights. It is unconscionable. That's basically the rule. And I think that's where we get to, fine, it can be viewed as binding, but it still has to comply with the unconscionability analysis, which the Pinnacle Court did. Went through the procedural unconscionability, went through the substantive unconscionability. The concurring opinion is a slightly different standard. It said that CC&Rs are more like an equitable servitude, so the standard was unreasonableness. Whether it's unconscionability or unreasonableness, there is still a limit. And this particular, for example, 1716, says that the cost of arbitration shall be borne equally by the parties. That's contrary to Chapter 40. It said that the prevailing parties...
Well, but wait a second on that. That's the cost of the litigation, and that's no different. That's not saying that the ultimate cost shall be borne equally. I mean, there's a difference there, and I think your opposing counsel concedes, and I may be confusing the cases, but that you get, if you prevail in arbitration, you get costs and attorney's fees, and that the arbitrator's failure to award that would be manifest disregard of law. So I'm struggling to understand that as substantively unconscionable.
Because
and it's not one-sided, it's a two-way street.
Right, but the statute is not a two-way street. The statute takes allows the claims to recover those fees.
But not as they're going. I mean, if you're in litigation with someone else, you've got to pay your own experts until you get to judgment, generally.
Here's the way I interpret that concession by Mr. King. He understands that if this document is read and enforced so as to abrogate the Chapter 40 rights, fees, costs, definition of defect, notices, post-prepared documents to give to a new buyer and so forth, then it would be unconscionable. So what does he do? Oh, we're not intending to take away Chapter 40 rights. You get all those rights and can enforce and so forth. But the document does not say that. That is a matter of argument, a matter of concession to find a position from which to argue. So the court, it seems to me, has two choices. One to say, no, this attempt to abrogate Chapter 40 rights is too much, it's unconscionable, we're not going to enforce it. Or, plan B, if you will, is to say, we will enforce it because of Nevada's policy in favor of arbitration, but only if it is interpreted so as to preserve all Chapter 40 rights. And that kind of is the teeter-totter, which way the court might go.
So are you? How do you address the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area that says that you can't apply these arbitration, you can't apply these rules particularly to arbitration clauses? Would this be consistent, this hypothetical? Suppose the provision in the arbitration clause, the provision in the CC&R said that I can't sell my home to a black person. Would seem like I'd be applying unconscionability and other rules equally to void out that provision, wouldn't I?
I think that would be an unconscionable provision.
And so too would that same defense be applicable even under current Supreme Court jurisprudence in knocking out an arbitration clause that has a provision that is similar.
When you say similar, I mean also unconscionable.
Yes.
Yes, I think there is. A body of law that says the unconscionable provision should be stricken. In fact, even the FAA basically allows that. The standard contract defenses are applicable even under the FAA. So in a way, we are enforcing the FAA by saying you cannot enforce an unconscionable arbitration.
So who gets to make this call? This court or the arbitrator? That's one of the problems.
My view of that argument is always like asking a barber with a union haircut, asking a $500 an hour arbitrator whether something should go to arbitration or not, or whether standards should be in arbitration. I think that Mr. King's comment about guidance from the court, I think, does boil down to either terms that attempt to abrogate Chapter 40 rights are going to be unconscionable, or they can have arbitration, but it would be construed only to be unconscionable only if all Chapter 40 rights, damages, and so forth are preserved. As much as we might like Mr. King's concession in these few cases, he may not be on the next case, or the next case after that, or the next case. And that's why I think that the concession is helpful for a result, but it doesn't help enough in terms of the analysis of the next season.
Right, but going with Justice Hardesty's hypothetical about a CC&R provision that says you cannot sell your home to a black person. Let's say that same CC&R had an arbitration provision, and this was the source of the contest, whether or not that was enforceable. Who would decide the enforceability of that provision in the first instance?
The trial court. The trial court, at the point of someone seeking a motion to compel arbitration.
They would decide arbitrability, but the legality of that limitation in the CC&Rs under conventional arbitration analysis would be for the arbitrator, would it not?
I think it would be for the trial court to decide whether or not that agreement is unconscionable without term. I think that would go to the trial court first, in the first instance.
So you would say that the trial court decides the contract defense to the contract as a whole and what law applies, even though you have a binding arbitration agreement?
Yes, I think Gonski, Birch, and Green are clear that, at least if those remain the law in Nevada, that the trial court is basically the decider on whether something goes to arbitration.
No, I agree with that. The trial court decides whether it goes to arbitration, but once you get to arbitration, the question of whether or not a particular clause in the CC&Rs is enforceable is for the arbitrator to decide, correct?
You know, when it says in one of these agreements that the arbitrator is to decide arbitrability, I think that...
I'm not focused on that. I'm just doing conventional analysis. The district court judge decides whether there is an enforceable agreement to arbitrate, correct?
Yes.
But the arbitrator, if it goes to arbitration, decides questions of law arising and governing the party's dispute and how it comes out, right?
I think that's right. But apply, basically, the law that they think applies.
And the safeguard, it's not the usual vigorous appellate review, but if it's the arbitrator reaches a result that is in manifest disregard of law, whether you're under the FAA or the UAA, the court doesn't have to uphold that result, correct?
That is correct.
So what gets slippery for me in this unconscionability and your discussion of, well, this carves into a Chapter 40 right, is why isn't it for the arbitrator in the first instance to decide whether, as a matter of law, if your clients prevail, they get attorney's fees? And for us then to look at the end result and say, the arbitrator misapplied Chapter 40. Under Chapter 40, these people had the right to attorney's fees. The arbitrator didn't award them. That was a manifest disregard of law. Reverse, send back. I don't understand why that doesn't work, and then it takes off so much of the unconscionability analysis, except for conventional, truly one-sided, you know, where you have to arbitrate and they don't, that kind of unequal rule.
Well, I think that's...
long question, I apologize.
I believe it's, I would call it hopeful thinking, that the arbitrator would apply the full range of Chapter 40 procedures and damages and interest.
Well, Mr. Shinnick, if I understand your argument, isn't your argument that the substantive law embodied in the document itself is implicit as a part of the analysis done by the trial court in deciding whether or not this is arbitrary? So that's why the judge must make that call as opposed to the arbitrator in the first instance.
In the substantive law, we're referring to the Chapter 40 process and the rights
of the arbitrator. Or in my hypothetical, whether under substantive law you can have a provision in CC&Rs that precludes a homeowner from selling to a person of minority.
I do think that initial decision stays with the trial court. In terms of the... But when they have the risk, Your Honor, is that when there are terms that are actually in the CC&Rs or a sales agreement that are contrary to Chapter 40, doesn't that, unless the court provides the guidance that says the clause of the Chapter 40 rights must be preserved in order to have arbitration, otherwise it's contrary to public policy, the risk is that the errors will be made throughout by enforcing the actual language of the CC&Rs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This matter will stand submitted.